Transportation as well as iron making came to be concentrated in the coalfields. A path-breaking English canal, completed by the Duke of Bridgewater in 1761, linked his coal mines at Worsley to the fledgling industrial center of Manchester. The cost of coal there dropped by half. Other coal-carrying waterways followed. Tracks of iron-reinforced wood, laid in the late 18th century to carry coal-bearing wagons from the mines to the rivers and seaports, inspired the idea of replacing horses with coal-burning steam engines. In the 1810s, George Stephenson, a colliery engine wright, perfected what became the first locomotive. By 1830, the island kingdom mined 4/5 of the world's coal, and in 1848 produced more iron than the rest of the world put together. Taken together, coal, iron, steam engines, and railways were the Industrial Revolution. By the end of the 19th century, more than half of the British towns of more than 50,000 people were situated on or near coalfields. The regional redistribution of English population in the 18th and 19th centuries to the North and Midlands was likewise coal-driven, historians agree. This was also the zenith of British invention, much of it by skilled craftsmen and engineers, not men of scientific learning. Because of this idiosyncratic imprint, British metallurgy, to take one example, was mostly a collection of small family firms, the sort that cherished and maintained old machinery. Large-scale U.S. and German iron and steel enterprises, backstopped by research laboratories and technically attuned university systems, cut a new swath in the early 1900s and left British competition behind. Cambridge historian Corelli Barnett, in The Collapse of British Power, wryly described Britain circa 1914 as, in many ways, a working museum of industrial archaeology. Here clanked on tirelessly not only the actual machines, but, not so tirelessly, the techniques and outlook of 1815 to 1850. Marvels of inventiveness and progress in their epoch, but transformed by the passage of time into quaint memorials of the original Industrial Revolution. Some still survive in popular British museums, a fate also overtaking the machinery of U.S. oil and automobile culture. By Queen Victoria's death, coal mining itself was more efficient in Germany and America. Despite large-scale British production, many mines were old, with the cheaper-to-reach coal already taken. The most revealing dimension involved coal derivatives, which until the 1850s had been a British-dominated field. A geologist in coal-rich Scotland had extracted sal ammoniac from soot in 1756, and 2 decades later, another Scot began the exploitation of coal as a source of coal tar and chemicals. Coal gas for illumination, developed in the 1790s, was first used to light British factories at night during the Napoleonic Wars. As late as 1856, William H. Perkin, a trained chemist, discovered the first aniline dye based on coal distillation. Thereafter, innovation shifted to Germany, abetted by British willingness to export large quantities of coal tar. By 1914, drugs and dyestuffs had become a German near monopoly and prime export. Much the same materials were critical for making high explosives. According to the post-war history of the British Ministry of Munitions, in August 1914, therefore, the Germans were in the fortunate position of being able to turn with ease the vast resources of a flourishing coal tar industry to the production of high explosives. Britain, in short, had been left at the gate. The spirit of Newcomen, Darby, and Perkin had been missing for at least a generation. Just as the Dutch had been left behind by the 18th century Industrial Revolution, some economic historians suggest that coal-shaped Britain was left behind by a second Industrial Revolution, circa 1900, that elevated chemicals, petroleum, and electrical engineering, all industries requiring large firms, scientific laboratories, educated workforces, and economies of scale.